Well, today we're going to go back in time. We're going to discover a little bit about ham radio and how it worked for setting up what we call Silicon Valley. So a story we're familiar with is the Homebrew Computer Club, where those two Steve, Wozniak and Jobs, got together. Wozniak had found a cheap 6502 microprocessor that he thought, hey, I can use all the Motorola parts with this cheap processor and make me a computer, which he called the Apple One, mainly to sell it to friends. He was a ham, kind of something you would do as a ham. You just want to show everybody else how to do it. But Steve Jobs says, no, let's turn this into a business. So they called it Apple Computer Company, started in a garage, which is a prerequisite in Silicon Valley, and now it's the largest market capitalization in the world. So how did that happen, and why did it happen to happen in the San Francisco Bay Area? What's so special about our area? Well, before 1990, we were the Valley of Heart's Delight. So this is pretty much what you saw in the springtime, was acres, miles of blossoms, and this was our main export. Cherries and apricots, things like that. So that was more typical of what we had, and Leland Stanford in the 1880s said, someday you will see Palo Alto blooming with nearly all the flowers of the earth and the fruits and shade trees of every zone. In the future, we'll can this fruit and send it all over the globe in exchange for wealth, which they did for quite a few years, but eventually technology overtook agriculture, and it became the thing that we export from this Valley of Heart's Delight. Well, let's go back. Federal Telegraph, formed in 1909 by a guy named Cyril Elwell, a Stanford engineering grad, and he started the first company. There's a milestone I'll show you later on this, but Lee DeForest came and worked for him. How many of you recognize the name Lee DeForest? All right, us engineers know that he's the guy who invented the vacuum tube. Most of you have seen a vacuum tube, okay. Well, anyway, he came out to Palo Alto. He was escaping some people in New York who wanted to get a hold of him and put him in jail. So he spent a couple of years in Palo Alto, where he patented the oscillator, we're familiar with that, and the amplifier circuit, as well as working on continuous wave radio and better vacuum tubes. And so the one I'm going to pass around now, it's an Audion from that era. Handle it carefully. You can see what's involved in it. I'll pass this around to the back, and then John will pick it up later. But get to everybody. This was from about 1914, and so it's a sample that I have on that. So I'm going to pass it through this main section, then we'll hit the wings. So move that on back and around. Don't drop it, Mike. Okay. You noisy kid. Anyway, Federal Telegraph got their claim to fame with the ARC transmitter that replaced the old SPARC transmitter that was a broadband noise generator, basically. And so they bought the rights to this from a guy in Denmark, the Paulson transmitter, and they could send CW and voice, which was really, really rather unique in those days. They raised funds from what we call angel investors. David Starr Jordan, the president of Stanford, kicked in $500, which is like $20,000 today, and several other faculty people put in some money. And so there's the first venture capital. And they demonstrated, here's something from the San Francisco Star, a cartoon, demonstrated reliable communication between San Francisco and Hawaii, a big thing for those days. But I want to point out the venture capital aspect, raising money, and also the involvement of the university that graduated these guys. Stanford put in some of their own staff and faculty money. Well, by 1920s, Federal Telegraph had high power stations in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Portland that covered most of the Pacific Ocean. And so they could send messages to ships at sea and get messages back for, who knows, 3 cents a word or whatever you charged in those days. This is the plaque in California, the California Historical Plaque up at Channing and Emerson in Palo Alto that commemorates Federal Telegraph. Well, the first regular commercial radio broadcast was, as some of you know, in San Jose. Charles Herhold was a Stanford engineering student. And he started a company in San Francisco, but the 1906 earthquake destroyed it. So he thought, I'm going to go to someplace safe. I'm going to go to San Jose and start something. And it was out behind what's now the Fairmont Hotel, and started a radio school. He would teach radio skills to young people. And he had they would make their own receivers, and then he would transmit every Wednesday night. He had a half hour program called San Jose Calling. And so he would send out information to them, and then his wife would go down to the local record store and get a couple of the records and play them on the air. So it was music and voice. It was a station, he called it Station FN, which became, well, KCBS. We all know that that big station in San Francisco, which derived from that. Okay, so early entrepreneurs, one of them was Otis Moorhead. He was a Stanford engineering grad, and he liked to make vacuum tubes. He started his own company in San Francisco, Moorhead Laboratories, and he manufactured bootleg receiving tubes for radios. Now, if you only make a few hundred, nobody's going to notice. But if you start making thousands, as you can see in this picture, he had a real setup there, somebody might shut you down. And so he was sued for patent infringement, and they put him out of business in the early 1920s. Intellectual property is a big part of what formed San Francisco, so this is a very early lesson. Well, the defining events of those days, first of all, there was a lot of independent wealth because of the gold rush. So San Francisco had a lot of money. There was still a lot of gold coming out of the hills. The Titanic sinking in 1912 was a big event. You remember that was radio was involved in that. The Carpathian's radio operator had already gone to bed because the radio operators were employed by the radio companies, not the steamship lines. And so they couldn't get rescues there real quickly. Anyway, they realized the importance of radio for ship to shore, and especially for disaster response. This is the Titanic sinking. But also in World War I, the U.S. Navy realized, hey, this communication stuff is really important. And so they put a lot of money and focus into it. Also the economics. You can put telegraph lines, 82 lines going from Wichita to Salt Lake City or something, but then you've got to go out and maintain them. You remember the Wichita lineman in the song had to go out and check the lines. Well, wouldn't it be neat if you could avoid all that and just send something by radio from here to maybe 800 miles away or 1,000 miles away? So this wireless technology brought a lot of investment and a lot of frenzy and activity to the Bay Area. So we're going to follow three of these early pioneers, Bill Eitel, Jack McCullough, and Charlie Litton. This picture on the right, that's Charles Litton when he was 11 years old in Palo Alto. And he had you can't read the door there, but he says wireless house. And he had a couple of 100-foot antennas there. So here's an 11-year-old kid, much like you probably were, experimenting with radio in those early days. This is back in about 1910, 1915. And he was born and raised in this area. Bill Eitel took shop classes at Los Gatos High School. I like to say that's because Homestead High School wasn't there yet. At any rate, his father had a quarry up in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And so he would go up and work there, but also his uncle had a company, the Hall Scott Motor Car Company, over in Oakland. And he would go over there in the summers, and he'd learn how to operate the machinery, invent new fixtures, put things together over there. He was quite a mechanical whiz, W6UF. And so he was one of these local kids interested in technology. Jack McCullough and Charlie Litton went to the California School of Mechanical Arts, which we know now as Lick Wilmerding High School up in San Francisco. And it was started by Lick to educate boys and girls in California at the high school level in the mechanical arts and in technology. And Litton said he got a realistic feeling for materials and processes while he was a high school kid up at the California School of Mechanical Arts. Jack McCullough was W6CHE. So McCullough went on to the local junior college, and Litton enrolled at Stanford's engineering school, which was a modest regional school at that time. And he took classes there. They had a strong practical flavor. Remember, the Stanfords wanted to educate California's children to become the next leaders and contributors to the local economy. So he got his bachelor's degree in 1924. And at that time, in 24, they started up a communications engineering thing. Normally, you would graduate in mechanical engineering or chemical engineering. There wasn't an electrical engineering major at that time. You would get your bachelor's degree, as Terman did, in chemical engineering, and then you'd go on for your engineer's degree in a specialty, which might be electrical power or electrical propulsion or something like that in those days. Anyway, it was a small department, and Litton took that first course on communication engineering fundamentals and got hooked. So they got introduced to amateur radio by their families and friends in the early 1910s and 1920s. It was big in the Bay Area. The Bay Area was an isolated maritime port servicing the whole Pacific Ocean, trade with Pacific Rim countries, and they needed radio operators for their ships. So there was a lot of need for them and a lot of training. A lot of people knew about radio and were experimenting with it. And at that point, when they started licensing in about 1920 or 21, there were 1,200 licensed amateurs here, which was 10% of the U.S. total, which makes no sense. So obviously there's a bubble here, and I think we missed that at the time. But something was going on out here that wasn't happening in Detroit or Chicago or New York or New Jersey. So this was an active center of radio production. There were a lot of firms. Remmler made radio sets. If you spell that backwards, it's Radio Elmer. Magnavox made loudspeakers. They started up in Napa County and moved to Oakland. Heinz and Kaufman, I'll talk a little bit about them, made custom HF radio equipment. And Federal Telegraph, which I mentioned, was doing the ARC transmitters, and they produced radio transmitters, up to a million watt transmitters in 1919. They had them in Spain, in the Canal Zone, in Singapore, on the East Coast, in Virginia, and around the West Coast. So it was getting to be quite a big operation. The neat thing for hobbyists was that there were a lot of parts available. So if you happen to think, as a young person, that you wanted to get into radio, probably you could get the parts free or for not much money. Fred Terman used to go down to Federal Telegraph and get parts, because that was only about a mile and a half from his house. Also, there were a lot of jobs for people who knew about radio, such as radio amateurs. If you were one of the hobbyists, you could get a job when you're 18 or 20 years old on a ship or a ship-to-shore communication system or something like that. So a lot of jobs, a lot of parts. It's quite a hobbyist center. The thing about the ham radio subculture is there's a lot of sociability. Most of us nerds, you know, we'd rather look at our shoes and talk about, well, probably not talk to anybody, really. But if you happen to have something to talk about, like radio, you can actually talk to somebody. And so nerds are and people like us, that are going to be engineers when they grow up, are much better at talking maybe over the air to somebody, or getting together like this and talking ham radio with people, as opposed to talking, you know, what are you doing and things like that. So it's a very egalitarian group. As Eitel said when he was chairing the Santa Clara County Radio Club, he says, in that we had farm boys and Stanford students and Federal Telegraph technicians and retired executives all working shoulder to shoulder on this hobby. It was a unique thing. You didn't see it in most other hobby areas, and certainly not in companies. So this subculture was mainly grassroots hobbyists. And so they were interested in extending this radio technology, which was quite new in the 1920s. They built their personal reputations by either maybe creating a new circuit or a better receiver or transmitter, or making contacts to faraway lands. I just talked to somebody in Southern California. Oh, wow, I talked to somebody in Oregon. This was long distance in those days. So it's a lot like that homebrew computer club I described earlier. It's hobbyists getting together, trying to do something better, and then sharing it with the others, kind of like we do in ham radio. It's a lot like Silicon Valley is today. It's a sharing culture, a lot of helping other people. Well, another young pioneer, Fred Terman, he and his family, when he was about 7 years old, moved out to San Bernardino. His dad, Louis Terman, was the principal of San Bernardino High School, which is where I went to high school. That was much before my time, though. And then he went to Glendale and worked for the Los Angeles Normal School, which we know of as UCLA today. And then Stanford hired him to come up on the campus. So we find Fred Terman there on faculty row in a rental house, he and his family. And across the street, Herbert Hoover, who has made a lot of money now in mining engineering, has come back to campus. He's living about a block and a half away. And his son, Herbert Hoover Jr., and Roland Marks, the son of the civil engineering professor, and George Branner, the son of the, Branner, who is the geologist, and Jack Franklin, the son of the chemistry professor, all got together and played with radio in about 1915 or so. And Herbert Hoover Jr. writes, he says, all three of us were neighbors, and upon pushing the key of one of our imposing contraptions would holler out the window to see if it had been received on the other side of the street. So these are guys playing around with this stuff in their spare time. They didn't electrocute themselves. Worked out okay. There's a picture of Herbert Hoover back Jr. back in 1923, one of these faculty brats that was working on radio on the campus. So young Fred Terman, he said, hey, if you saw a 90-foot pole sticking up somewhere, you'd go and knock on the door and get acquainted with him, kind of like we do. We see a new antenna go up, we've got to go see who it is, check his license plate, things like that, look him up. Try to get introduced, because maybe there's equipment there you can borrow or use or something you can learn. Well, Fred Terman, as I mentioned earlier, hung out at Federal Telegraph, which was a few blocks away, and he also worked there one summer during high school. And so he not only had this hobby interest, but he actually got a job working on these very large transmitters, which I'll show you a picture of later. And there's Fred Terman, 17, in his shack. The banner says Harvard, but he actually went to Stanford and MIT. Well, we're going to follow these entrepreneurs, Eitel, Litton, and McCullough. They were ham friends, and they built their own vacuum tubes. That wasn't unusual in those days. This one I'm passing around, you can see, is fairly simple. They made quite a few contributions. For example, Litton, when he was at Stanford in 1924, made the first radio contact down south with Australia and New Zealand. This is getting to be DX now. This is distance transmission. And in 1928, Eitel pioneered the 10-meter band, what we think was the 30 megahertz band, for transcontinental communication. So these are pioneers trying new things and showing other people how to do it. Well, the tube business, remember I mentioned Morehead earlier being shut down making tubes. The tube business was pretty much controlled by General Electric, Westinghouse, and AT&T, the big East Coast companies. That's where the technology came from, because all of Lee DeForest's patents were eventually sold to AT&T and moved back to New Jersey, and that's where a lot of that new technology came about. Well, they developed new high-power transmitting tubes in the early 1920s. They're hard to make. They're made by hand. They're not as reliable as you'd like. You might be able to run it for 20 or 30 hours, and then you get air into it, and it destroys itself, or something goes wrong. They're not very repeatable. It required precise machining, blowing Pyrex glass to make the tubes, things like that. A lot of difficulty sealing them. So our entrepreneurs had an interesting job. Litton got a job through a ham friend at this Federal Telegraph company I mentioned. And Leonard Fuller was Stanford's first engineering PhD in 1919. He was chief engineer there. You'll see a picture of him later. And it built up to about 60 engineers, and it became the sole supplier of radios for International Telephone and Telegraph, ITT. So AT&T kind of had a lock on the U.S. market, and ITT sold in Europe and the Far East and places like that. And so they had that as their market. Eitel, meanwhile, became a mechanic at Heinz and Kaufmann, this other HF radio company I mentioned. Heinz himself was a fan, was a ham, and he focused on HF radio equipment, specialty stuff for people who could afford better gear. And they recruited McCullough the next year. And the picture here is Federal Telegraph's offices there in the old Perham home. Some of you may know the Perham collection. It used to be at Foothill College. I'm not quite sure where it is now, but anyway, that was the stuff that Perham pulled together. And the place on the left over there, that little building, was where Lee DeForest and a couple of his assigned technicians did further improvement on the Audion tube. Well, the tube business was an interesting one. You couldn't buy transmitting tubes on the open market. They were restricted goods because the U.S. government wanted to control that technology. So the Navy and General Electric set up a new company called Radio Corporation of America, RCA. You've heard of that. To ensure that the U.S. had dominance. And RCA, so other companies in the nation, had to either be sold to an RCA partner or shut down. So Telefunken, Marconi all became U.S. companies. And then they RCA licensed these patents back to GE, Western Electric, and Westinghouse, and they were exclusively able to use those patents. Our West Coast companies didn't have access to those patents. So the sole producers for these high-power tubes were on the East Coast, and they wouldn't sell them to our Bay Area companies like Heinz and Kaufman because that was exporting technology, and we didn't want to do that. So it was a real, plus it was a marketing threat to RCA. So either way, our West Coast companies didn't have access to transmitting tubes, a real problem. So both companies had to have their own tube divisions. They had to develop their own triodes. And so Litton and Eitel headed up these two tube shops at these two different companies. The tough part was designing around RCA's patents. You know, if you're a patent attorney like Andre, you know that intellectual property is one of the real big issues. You don't want to infringe somebody's patent because they could shut down your whole process. So it was enormously difficult. So they hired many local people. A lot of them had radio background. Eitel and Litton collaborated with each other. Now, they're competing companies, right? Why would people work together? Well, that's our subculture. They had worked together as hams. They kept working together on, well, how do you do this? I'm having this problem. What's going on here? How did you solve this? So it's kind of like going down to the wagon wheel back in the 60s and trading ideas about, gee, my process is having this problem. How did you solve it? That's where you get together after work at the IC companies. And so it was based on their friendship and their ham radio backgrounds over the years. They also worked closely with their own patent attorneys, first, to make sure they didn't infringe other patents, and second, to go ahead and patent new things that they felt would be better. For example, the original patent that RCA held for the triode said that this grid, this plate, surrounded the grid and the cathode. Well, let's see, that's 360 degrees. What if I made it 170 degrees and put two of them there? Well, that's a new patent. So they found ways to make things that were different from what was already patented. So Heinz, Eitel, and McCullough engineered a rugged new power tube, new material so it didn't infringe the old ones. They used tantalum, for example, better manufacturing methods, and new shock-resistant seals. The guy who was great on process development was Charlie Litton. So he developed the oil vacuum pump, for example, to pump these tubes down, and better sealing techniques, things like that. And they created higher vacuums, which gave them better reliability for their tubes. And so they were more reliable and lasted longer than the RCA tubes built by GE and Westinghouse and so on. But the key thing was it didn't infringe the patents. That was the important thing. So Litton, one of the things he invented was called the glass lathe. You see it in the lower right here. He could take this Pyrex glass, put it on the lathe. He had a center of rotation. He had great repeatability for glass blowing, for sealing, and everything. So he could make pretty good quantities of parts with high repeatability on this lathe. And so he built it on a shed in the back of his property, which almost qualifies as a garage. So we sort of grandfathered him into being a garage startup. And so we'll come back to Litton a little bit later. The Depression hit in the 1930s. And this was a tough time for all kinds of businesses, but certainly for radio also. And so Eitel and McCullough, Heinz and Kaufman had been sold and was shutting down a lot of their stuff. So these two guys had made a better tube within Heinz and Kaufman, but they thought we could make a better one for the hams. They wanted to build a high-power, high-frequency tube that would work up in those useless bands that the government let us play with up there. And so they built the new 150T, which some of you probably have read about in the past, but they needed some financing. These are guys in the 1930s, right? So they found a couple of people. Harrison had real estate. He was a real estate agent in San Bruno. And Preddy had a string of theaters in San Francisco. And they each put up $5,000. And in return, they got 50% of the enterprise of IMAC. And Eitel and McCullough kept the other 50%. It's kind of this idea of venture capital, all right? And so one of them sold their $5,000 investment for about $140,000 around the start of World War II. Another one kept it for a while and made $250,000. So again, you see that venture capital is working. They invested extra funds and eventually paid off. Well, Eitel and McCullough brought their know-how and pursued these new tube ideas, mainly with the ham radio community in mind. If you read all their stuff, they're building tubes for radio operators. And this was the precursor then for what we see in Menlo Park today, these venture capital firms starting up lots of startups. And here in the Plug and Play Center, startups started trying something new. Well, the interesting thing, Litton, Eitel, and McCullough again cooperated closely. Litton helped set up the IMAC tube factory up in San Carlos. He gave them castings for his glass lathe and gave them the blueprints so they could make their own. He didn't really want to be making those things. He had better things to do, but he was happy to have them using it. And they freely exchanged technical information and also information about contracts and where they might get business and stuff like that. And this was important because it reduced the risk of these little companies. They're not big companies like IBM or AT&T. They're little guys like, well, if you accept Google and Facebook, they're like Silicon Valley companies. They're little companies that may make it big, but may never be big. They instead just trade on each other's abilities to help them. So you use your own specialty. So it reduced the risk, kind of like when Jobs and Wozniak started up at the Homebrew Computer Club. You're trading with each other for ideas. Well, in 1936, Fred Terman asked Charlie Litton to join the faculty as a lecturer and help in the labs and show his engineering students how things worked. And so he spent some time on the campus and shared knowledge with the staff and students there. And as part of a licensing by Stanford to Sperry, there was $1,000 that was supposed to be paid to Litton. And Litton said, that's not much money. That's like, what, $15,000, $20,000, $30,000 a day. He says, give it to Terman. He can do something with it. So Terman says, I had an engineer who graduated in 34 who's now got a job at General Electric on the East Coast. And remember, this is the Depression, so having a job, you don't give that up easily. Well, he writes to this guy and says, I've got $1,000. I'll give you $500 to cover you and Lucille's living expenses for the next year while you work on your master's degree, and you got $500 for lab equipment. So Dave and Lucille hop in their car and come back to Stanford and starts working with Bill Hewlett on some stuff that Bill Hewlett had invented while an undergrad, and made a new product, and they formed their company called Hewlett and Packard. I don't remember if that was a coin flip. Could have been Packard and Hewlett, I suppose. Anyway, here again, we have the university cooperating with local engineers. They've got Fred Terman getting these guys together, helping them get a company started in a garage. You see the garage there, it's still there. So at that time in the 30s, there was a growing threat to peace from Japan and Germany. And President Roosevelt was investing money to build up the Army and the Navy. And there was something new that was invented in Britain called radio detection and ranging, or radar. They discovered that They could take an HF signal and they could send it out, and then they could listen. They could say, oh, that's about 30 miles, and it's bigger than a side of a barn, but I can't tell much about it. Well, they really needed to get higher power and also go to higher frequencies so they could see smaller and smaller, discern smaller and smaller things. So one of the first IMAC tubes was the 50T. You see it here in the picture. And it could handle high voltages, up to several thousand volts, and frequencies up to 200 megahertz. So all of a sudden, the Navy had this neat tube that they could use for doing what they thought of as high frequency. We think of it as just VHF. But high frequency radar. They could send signals out and get them back again, these pulses. And so in 1940, as we start getting into the war, they had an order for the first 10,000 tubes. Well, they were making about 200 tubes a week at that point. So they had to really grow fast, which they did. They expanded they built a plant up in Salt Lake City, and they grew really big. They built about 3 million of these tubes during World War II. Grew quite large. Okay, so one of the tubes, this is more recent now, is Mike Yamamoto here? He was going to be here. Anyway, he gave me some of these. This is a 3-500Z. The 3 means it's a triode. This is what you might see in the late 60s. This was designed in 68 as a transmitting tube. So a pair of these gives a ham full legal power. Not too bad. I'll pass this one around. So this is what the tube developed into during World War II and a little bit beyond. This one was built in 1980, by the way. Okay, so the late 30s, we've got a couple of guys, Russell and Sigurd Varian. Two kids grew up in Palo Alto and then went down to Harmony down near San Luis Obispo and grew up in basically a commune, I guess. But anyway, they were worried about Germany and the ability of Germany to have planes bombing and stuff like that. So they thought, hey, wouldn't it be neat if you could get to really high frequencies, up to microwave frequencies, because then you could detect some things that are really small, like airplanes and stuff like that. So in 1937, Russ Varian moved to Stanford's lab, working with Bill Hansen, who is the famous physicist who developed the theory behind the MRI and different stuff like that. The linear accelerator. At any rate, he would work on ideas, and he'd come to Bill and say, hey, here's some great stuff. And Bill would say, that won't work, but hey, pursue this. Let's go in this direction. So back and forth over a year and a half or so, and they developed what we know of as the klystron, which I think of as the first integrated circuit because it's a tube with tuned little antennas, and you know, it's sort of an integrated set of circuits. Anyway, they developed the klystron, and it was announced in 1939. And here you see the Palo Alto Times, which is maybe not where you'd expect to see technology, and the headlines talks about the guy on the left there, the president, talking to this guy named Adolf Hitler, and Hitler saying, just give me one more country, maybe Czechoslovakia, and I will stop. Okay, well, but the real headline is the one I've got circled. New Stanford radio invention heralds revolutionary changes. And so we see Russ and Sigurd Varian, the inventors of the klystron, the announcement of this klystron, which changed radio considerably in those days. It was variable frequencies, microwave, very neat for transmitting, but also for receiving. So Sperry invested in this during start of World War II, bought the rights to the klystron from Stanford, and then Litton was involved then in giving them equipment or selling them equipment like his lathes, developed a line of welders, he had these vacuum pumps, great stuff. Litton, meanwhile, stayed here and worked on klystrons for international telephone or telegraph. And they built some for France, but I think France got overrun before they were delivered. But at any rate, there was this radar need in Europe and around the world. And so they built klystrons, had various kinds of klystrons and advanced tubes for the World War II effort. So because of all this development, Stanford and the Bay Area became a hotbed for microwave technology development. A lot of it during World War II happened back at the Harvard Radio Labs, which Fred Terman and his guys headed up. But after the war, they came back to the campus. So the wartime expansion was quite interesting. It was a progressive approach to business that was used in the Bay Area. You remember Henry Kaiser and building ships, popping those out every few days? Well, he wanted his people to stay on site, kind of like Google or Facebook doing your laundry for you and detailing your car and giving you free food because they want you to stay there and work. Well, Kaiser had the same idea. Let's make these people healthy. So he started clinics, which became Kaiser Permanente Health System. And he had cafeterias and things like that. So he was really into the more progressive type of business with more egalitarian relationships between engineers, quality people, production people, finance people, that sort of thing. And it was great for thwarting unions because he could keep his employees happy and productive. But companies like Hewlett-Packard also did that. And I went through a long string of companies, including Tandem Computers. So, Mike, you remember at Tandem, well, sure. At Tandem, we had a rule. If in a meeting somebody came up with a new idea, you could not say anything bad about it for 5 minutes. Okay? You can't say, that's dumb, that would never work. Because if you do that, you shut people down, and they're not going to come up with new ideas. They're going to say, So instead, you have to figure out how it might work. Hey, we could have Jim do this, and Joan could, and we could work with, here's how we could make it work. So that was one of our rules at Tandem Computers. We had a whole bunch of interesting ones. But we also had profit sharing, where we could get stock every quarter. Tuition reimbursement started out here. Cafeterias, medical clinics I mentioned. There was the HP Way philosophy, which I won't go into, but many companies sprung out of that. Tandem was a spring off of HP, and so Jimmy Tribig, W6JKV, was... I used to go into Jimmy's office, we'd have a problem, and I'd put my feet up on his desk, say, Jimmy, we got a problem. Remember those days, Mike? Anyway, similar to what we see in a lot of startups here, like Google and so on, but back in those days, Hewlett-Packard, Fairchild, Intel, my company was Tandem. So after the war, there was a realignment. RCA decided to focus on broadcast television and things like that. NBC is basically a part of that RCA conglomerate, and GE and so on. iMac went on to develop a better set of tubes, like the 4-250A here, the tetrode, because the market was flooded with cheap triodes. They couldn't make those because there was lots of surplus, so they went on to build better tubes, and they made a good business out of it. Well, the FCC pulled a shocker. Experimental FM radio in those days was around 40 to 50 megahertz. And so when they decided to formalize FM radio as a band to supplant the AM radio band, everybody in RCA thought, hey, that's what they're going to do. They're going to formalize it. But they pulled a Swifty and put it up at 100 megahertz. Well, it turns out RCA's tubes worked poorly up there. So they wouldn't work properly. So they thought, well, the next best thing, we'll just copy the iMac tubes, right? Okay, which did work. So they copied the iMac tubes, and in 1947, iMac sued that conglomerate of companies, alleging patent infringement, and GE and RCA lost that lawsuit and had to shut down production. So iMac then was the maker of those tubes, but the other companies were the distributors. So you see my iMac inside here. Basically, the big dog now was Silicon Valley. Most of the high-frequency tubes were made on the peninsula, and I showed a picture earlier of iMac's plant that they opened in 1958 or 59 in San Carlos. Anyway, Charlie Litton, after the war, focused on these high-power klystrons, much bigger than me. They were huge. The nice thing about them was there wasn't a concentrated area that heated up like a cathode. Well, there was a little cathode. But the idea was you would capture these electrons and move them along and compress them into little spurts and tune them and everything, and you could get out megawatt power levels of these things. And they used it for physics research on the Stanford campus. They built linear accelerators. He built them starting about a 30 kilowatt level after World War II, up to 30 megawatts. There's three orders of magnitude. And he transformed Stanford into a major player. You see the 2 mile Stanford Linear Accelerator, which you drive by on 280 when you go up to San Francisco. And anybody who gets radiation therapy today is using a Litton Klystron in that radiation thing. That's where you generate the X-rays. And Litton developed a recipe for how to build a firm. He says, get a little initial capital, not too much. We don't want these guys to go crazy and put in white carpet and stuff like that, but enough to get going. Get an R&D contract or have some new idea, like here at the Plug and Play Center. Get an engineering team together, set up a product line, build some, go into production, sell some, iterate, make it better, see if you can make a market out of it. That was his approach. One example of what happened in those days that, again, involved this camaraderie between companies. The Varian brothers started their own company. You notice it's called Varian Associates, not Varian Corporation. It was to be an egalitarian team of 8 or 10 people working together without much hierarchy. And it stayed that way for a while. Anyway, they were making microwave equipment. And they had to make some microwave measuring equipment. And they built half a dozen of these test stations. But they weren't going to build very many of them. So they approached Hewlett-Packard and said, hey, for $20,000, we'll sell you the plans and teach you how to make this thing. HP thought, that's a good idea. So they bought the rights to this thing, got into the test equipment business, and turned into the Santa Rosa and Santa Clara divisions, which became Agilent, which was the largest IPO at those days. And now it's Keysight. Down in the lower left, you see the HP 200A audio oscillator, and Dave and Bill. So have any of you ever seen this mural up in Palo Alto and Courthouse Square? So I'll give you the address in a little while, or you can look it up. Kind of neat. It kind of captures what I've been talking about. With Stanford as the background, you see, I can only show one of you guys this, but over here on the left, you see Lita Forrest here with his tube. Here's Ernest Lawrence at UC Berkeley. This great big black thing behind these guys on the left is the pole piece for one of these arc transmitters. This is about a 1 million watt arc transmitter. Well, there was one sitting out in the back in Palo Alto for about 10 years, rusting behind the old plant because it couldn't sell it. And so Leonard Fuller went to UC Berkeley eventually, and he told Ernest Lawrence, hey, that little 5-inch cyclotron is kind of neat. What could you do with a 42-inch magnet? That would be pretty neat. So they took the magnet out of this arc transmitter, wound the coils on it, and gave it to Ernest Lawrence. And that resulted in about 6 Nobel Prizes before 1960 in high-energy physics. So here we've got stuff spreading out across the valley. You see over on the left, here's Doc Herhold, broadcasting on San Jose Calling. Over in the right, in the front, is his wife, who is listening in this case, but she's the one who spun the records. You see in the middle, we've got Fred Terman standing at the bench there. Come on. Here we go. Here's the other one. Nice to have always good to have a spare. I'm from Tandem Computers. So you see him talking to Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard here at the bench with their oscillator there. And over here are the radio guys, Philo Farnsworth, who invented electronic television up in San Mateo or someplace, and Heinz and Kaufman guys and so on. And you may recall that the very first product that Hewlett-Packard came out with was this oscillator built on the nice thing about this oscillator, Bill Hewlett had this patented idea that you could put a light bulb in the circuit, basically to ballast it, and you could change the frequency and the amplitude stayed steady. Pretty unusual. Didn't have to tune a frequency and then set the amplitude. And they sold the first 8 of those to Walt Disney for the Fantasia movie in 1939. That was the first company that was their customer. So this mural is up in Palo Alto at the corner of Birch and Sheridan at Courthouse Square. And there's a company in there, but you're welcome to go in and look around when they're open. Actually, I went up there one evening, and there was a maid service cleaning this place, and I told them I wanted to see the mural. Okay, sure, come on in. And so we got to go see them. She turned on the lights and stuff. At any rate, I think it's going to get relocated somewhere on the Stanford campus the next couple of years. So fast forward to the 1950s. The picture in the middle, that's a little Bill Shockley, 8 years old, at his home in Palo Alto. He goes on to Caltech, goes to Bell Labs, and in 1947, he and his compatriots there, in 1948, John Bardeen and Walter Brattain, developed the point contact transistor, a novel thing. You don't have to have a filament to heat up. You can actually get amplification, oscillation, things like that, without all this extra power. Neat way to replace vacuum tubes, which were the hot thing in those, literally, in those days. So Shockley left the East Coast. He felt he wasn't appreciated at Bell Labs because these other two guys also got credit, and he has a big ego. Anyway, he went down to Caltech, and he was teaching down there, and Arnold Beckman said, hey, I'll fund a new company for you, a semiconductor, a transistor company, and you can locate it here in Culver City in Los Angeles. And Bill Shockley says, I don't think so. Not Culver City. So he came back up to Palo Alto, where his mother still lived. He was associated with Stanford, and she lived next to the campus. And he started his company in Mountain View in 1955, the Shockley Transistor Company. And you recall about 2 years later, the traitorous eight left because they could not stand his non-management style and started their own company called Fairchild with real venture capital put up by Sherman Fairchild. And so now we start seeing this start of other companies out there. We see Fairchild and then all the Fairchildren, all the transistor companies. A lot of the funding, of course, was DOD government money to buy $400 transistors, but it really put a lot of muscle into the local economy. And then Jean Harnais developed the planar process. That's the most important thing that was developed in this area, to be able to make integrated circuits, putting things together, and also the reliability of not having these exposed edges that get contaminants and start going bad. So where would you want to build these things? Well, where was the infrastructure for building this? Well, we had the high vacuum technology. Litton was a master in that. Precise furnaces for doing outgassing and things like that, developing materials, heating filaments and grids. Glass quartz capability. We had machinists who could machine quartz and glass blowing experts in the Bay Area. Ultra-pure gases and water, that was our specialty. In fact, in the early days, I like to tell people the secret to Silicon Valley is the water. We used to use the Hetch Hetchy water straight because it was so pure. Now you have to purify it, of course. And process control. We had a kind of a spirit of continuous improvement here. And so it made sense to go ahead and build these capabilities, build these products where the capabilities exist that were developed in the 20s, 30s, and 40s by these hams. And it all happened here. Here's the planar process plaque, an IEEE milestone. I was at the dedication there about 6 or 8 years ago, Charleston Road in Palo Alto, where Fairchild started. And Isaac Asimov, the famous science fiction writer, said the planar process is the most important moment since man emerged as a life form. And he's probably exaggerating a little bit, but, I mean, what do we get out of that? We've got smartphones that are more powerful than the old Apple II and things like that because of this planar process that was developed here and patented here. So at the end, the situation had changed dramatically. We had the peninsula and the valley as major electronic centers. About half the microwave tubes were being built on the peninsula. They were in every advanced weapon system and space system. We had traveling wave tubes in satellites, a wide range of industrial goods. We had broadcast TV. We had microwave ovens, which they originally called radar ranges, but that didn't go over too well. Nobody wanted to be near a radar range, so they renamed that. At any rate, Silicon Valley now is the center of the defense effort and the U.S. manufacturing economy that's developing, this new economy that replaces steel and forging and stuff like that. So in the East, the business climate was to have large vertically integrated companies where IBM had divisions that did everything, AT&T had divisions that in Western Electric that would build the stuff, they would install it, they would run it. Silicon Valley, on the other hand, was very fragmented, very diffuse and decentralized. We had a lot of specialized, nimble engineering companies, engineering-driven, with a particular thing in mind to build or a market they want to cover. And we had this dense regional network, this ecosystem of little companies to support you. So my specialty might be designing this sort of thing, but I would use their payroll system and their supplier system, and they had the specialty materials and so on. So it was a companies working together, kind of like that ham radio ethic. Also in California, in about 1873, they passed a law saying you can have employment contracts, but you cannot have non-compete clauses. You can put them in there, but the state of California will not enforce them, as you're seeing in recent Netflix and Verizon lawsuits. They're not going to enforce that. So that let us move people around. I might sign an employment contract. I can go somewhere else and compete against you from day one. I can't take your customer list or your secrets, but I can compete against you. Now, if you're in one of the roughly 38 states that doesn't have that kind of a clause, it might say you've got to pump gas for a year before you can actually go into business against your previous employer, which really slows down a lot of companies. Yes?
Really, since 1873?
1873. It was passed after the gold rush. And so since 1873, the state of California, the courts will not enforce non-compete clauses, which means that when you're getting together with somebody at the wagon wheel and they say, well, why don't you come work for us? You can move right away. Okay. It's very different in Massachusetts, one reason that they're much slower, or New Jersey in adopting new technology is because people cannot move easily like they can here. And also, we just adapt more rapidly to change. We seem to have that in our blood here. Somebody asked me once, is that because we're the descendants of these people who took off across the plains to go search gold? I says, no, it's not your heredity. It's the environment that makes it that way. Kids grow up knowing, I can do those things. I can get on a project in high school and work on this. I can work with my buddies on robotics and that kind of stuff. Whereas on the East Coast, it's much slower. So these practices and skills and competencies were developed over that 100 or so years and helped us get into analog, which is the part I described, and then digital, then software. We were a leader in biotech with Genentech and with Stanford's patents, Stanford UC's patent and that stuff. Mobile computing, big data, deep learning, virtual reality, self-driving autonomous vehicles, it's all right here. A lot of it happens right here. There's a lot of cutting-edge entrepreneurs, a large support group of engineers and venture capitals. Didn't want to do that. Local universities, San Jose State, Santa Clara, Stanford, UC Berkeley, putting out engineers, of course, but also giving opportunity for people to expand their knowledge and work cross-divisionally with other specialties. And then we had the support industries, plus we have the role models. When Steve Jobs wanted some advice on what to do, he went and talked to Bob, what's his name, over at Intel. Anyway, the idea that you will not only learn from other people, but other people will share with you. It's kind of that ham radio ethic. So we have this special culture of innovation. And so in the 40s and 50s, we had Shockley Semiconductor in the upper left. Okay, how many of you have an Apple phone? Okay, quite a few probably have an Apple phone. So why do they call that special voice recognition system Siri? Why is it called Siri? Well, it's because SRI is too hard to pronounce. The Stanford Research Institute, sprung off from Stanford in the anti-war business in the late 60s. And so SRI developed that technology. A couple of guys left and worked on it, and Apple bought the company. And they just always called it the Siri, the SRI, the Siri voice recognition. They kept it the same. So now you know that on an Apple, when you're talking to Siri, you're talking about SRI. So we had Ampex making tape decks. We had universities. Then in the 60s, we get these semiconductor companies, these fair children. We have Advanced Micro Devices, National Semiconductor. Intel starts up. Bob Noyce, that's what I was trying to think of. Intersil. You've got Memorex and ISS starting the disk drive business, springing off of IBM. That's a whole other story. In the 70s, we have the computer companies. Okay, we've got Tandem, Apple, Amdahl, where I also worked, four-phase systems. You've got Atari, video games. Who would have thought that putting this console and hauling it around on your back and putting it in a place would make a lot of money, playing Pong or Miss Pac-Man or something? And then it became a home game. Pretty neat. Genentech is founded to do monoclonal antibody stuff. In the 80s, now we get into software as a product. We've got Adobe, Intuit. You do your taxes this time of year with them. RSA. You've got networking. Cisco starts at Stanford with Sandra Lerner and her husband. You've got Silicon Graphics and MIPS doing high-power workstations to do films for Hollywood and things like that. Fry's Electronics, our favorite store besides Ham Radio Outlet. In the 90s, you've got lots of other interesting companies. Tesla is starting to build electric cars. Google, Juniper is now competing in networks. Facebook starts up. NVIDIA making deep neural network stuff that fits in the back of your car and runs your autonomous system. Netflix and Pandora, Salesforce, software as a service. Those all came out of the Bay Area. And companies are still moving here. Pretty much all of the technology that goes into cars is here. Ford wants to hire a couple more people near Stanford. GM bought Cruise Automation, 1,000 people in San Francisco. Toyota is investing $1 billion, about most of it around Stanford and some of it around MIT. Samsung has a problem, right? They've got their own little operating system for their smartphones. Plus, they've got appliances that have to be smart and TVs. So they like to buy up lots of little companies. But it's really hard to persuade these people to move to South Korea. So they bought a 10-story building over in Santa Clara. And they say, okay, we just bought you. You're on the second floor in the west wing, and you're on the fourth floor in the right that wing. And it becomes a hub of technology. This is where Samsung develops their technology. That was their model for how to make it work for them. That little company in the lower right, Walmart, has been around for about 15 years here in the Bay Area doing all of their just-in-time stuff. And all the car companies, plus the patent office now has an office in San Jose. Biotech, I mentioned Genentech. This all comes out of Stanford and UC San Francisco's recombinant DNA patent. Stanford's got $200 million over the years out of licensing that patent. And we've got all of these gene splicing and biotech companies. The question now is, where is Silicon Valley? We always thought, well, that's the Santa Clara Valley. But now it's more a metaphysical space. It really goes from Santa Cruz and Scotts Valley over to Pleasanton and up to Berkeley and Marin County, maybe up to Santa Rosa and down to Watsonville. So it's all over the place, and it's kind of a way of thinking. In fact, when they talk about a company like Twitter and say it's in Silicon Valley, and of course it's in San Francisco, you think, wait a minute, but we've just sort of taken over that whole space. And what about funding? Well, in the Bay Area, in the spring of 2014, about $7 billion in venture capital, 55% of the total. Boston, 10%, New York, 9%, Southern California, 6%, Texas, 3%. It's still right here. You can't do everything in the Valley. House prices are too high. You can't put everything here, so it has to go somewhere else too. But the bulk of the invention stuff, the technology invention, is still here. So how different are we? Well, Thomas Friedman from the New York Times, I kind of like him. He says, in Silicon Valley, great collaborators are prized. In Washington, D.C., they are hanged. When they say collaborator, they mean traitor, right? Republicans and Democrats working together. But in Silicon Valley, they mean colleague. So it goes back to that ham radio ethic of working together. And in Silicon Valley, failure is a feature, not a bug. On the East Coast, if your product fails and you're working on this team, you might be able to be the janitor or do continuation engineering. Out here, if it fails, I had a company fail from under me once, had to wheel my stuff out of the building. They want you on their next team, okay? Because you've got the experience and you've been through that, you can help them. So it's a different future, different look here. So I've passed around a sheet, some of them around, if you've got an extra one, pass it around, where you can download these slides. Here's my recommendation for reading. Making Silicon Valley says it goes from 1930 to 1970, but it really goes earlier. It's a good book about the history of how ham radio and how the technology developed here. Fred Terman at Stanford, a very good, rather thick book on how Stanford became this hub, what happened with Terman before the war with Hewlett and Packard and so on, and then during the war and after the war. Another fun book, maybe some of you have seen this, The Tube Guys by Norm Pond. I have an interview by him on the internet. At any rate, this is a great book, not only about what the tubes were like in those days as they developed, but a lot of the tube companies. You probably didn't realize GE had a tube operation in Stanford Industrial Park. Another one is the HP phenomenon. It talks about HP from the early 50s all the way through Mark Hurd. Neat book written by Chuck House, one of our locals. And so that's a fun book to read if you've got some time. It's a thick one. We've got Leslie Berlin's book on Bob Noyce, the man behind the microchip. One of those many Midwestern guys that ended up, well, he was in Philadelphia, and he got this call from Bill Shockley. He says, this is William Shockley. And Noyce says, it felt like a call from God. And so he came out and worked for Shockley Transistor and Form Fairchild and then Intel. Very good book to read. Leslie Berlin is a great historian on this. Another point of view, we've got Steve Jobs' book by Walter Isaacson. I've read that. My wife read it. She thought it was pretty good. Another view is Google. Okay, this is a different style. Wide open, sharing, you're just like a tandem. You're supposed to spend 5 or 6% of your time or 10% of your time on other things and going to conferences so you can bring technology back. How many of you have Netflix streaming? Some of you do. I would suggest, and I think this is on Amazon Prime also, look up Something Ventured about the venture capital firms. You'll see them talking about Cisco and Intel and Apple and Tandem and Genentech and talking to the people who actually founded those. So Jimmy Tribig is on there with his Texas drawl, Sandy Lerner, Gordon Moore. Very good. Thank you for sitting through this thing. I appreciate your time. If you are interested in more about this, the website or the download there is my slides. You can get those with recommendations. My email address is there. There's some interesting Silicon Valley history talks, which you can look up. And so thank you for your attention.